This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. A little bit later in the hour, naturalist E.O. Wilson is going to join us to talk about his plan for preserving the world's biodiversity. But first, this past December, former President Jimmy Carter announced that he was cancer-free. His brain scans showed no signs of melanoma. His treatment was a combination of radiation and immunotherapy, that is, using his own T cells for treatment. Researchers are looking at how they can refine this promising therapy even further so that it works for more people. Here to follow up on that story and other short subjects in science is Ed Young. He's a science writer for The Atlantic. Welcome back, Ed.
Hi, Ara.
So what kind of progress are we making in immunotherapy?
Well, so immunotherapy has been one of the great developments in cancer research in the last few years. Really advanced cases that seemed very bleak have gone into total remission. But the problem is that it doesn't seem to work for everyone. So a team of scientists from London looked at why. They wanted to see what immune cells actually recognize on tumors. So as tumors grow, they develop new mutations which influence the molecules on their surface, and these molecules act as red flags to the immune system. They say something is weird about these cells, and the more of these flags there are, the better people seem to do. But the thing is that not all mutations, not all of these flags are equal. Some develop very early on in a tumor's life and are found in every one of its cells. So let's call these trunk mutations. Others develop late and are only found in certain bits of a tumor. And let's call these the branches. So if your tumor has a large number of trunk mutations, you tend to do better. If there's loads of branches, you tend to do worse. And this sort of makes intuitive sense. You know, if you want to chop down a tree, you want to go after the trunk. You don't want to spend all your resources pruning back the branches.
Mm-hmm. Progress looking promising?
Right. So what they're trying to do now is to find T cells that go after these trunk mutations.
Oh,
and we know that those cells seem to exist in all kinds of different patients. So it's a question of finding them, expanding them, and finding ways of unleashing them. So it looks like tumors contain the seeds of their own destruction. They contain these trunk-sensitive T cells. And it's just a case now of finding ways of activating them. But that does seem hopeful. This seems to suggest why some people respond to immunotherapy and others don't, and ways of improving that proportion.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about another story about the immune system and how viruses have actually helped to build our immune system.
Right. So about 8% of the human genome consists of viruses, like viruses that once infected our ancestors and whose DNA has become a permanent fixture of our genomes. This has been known for a while, and it's been unclear what those sequences were actually doing. And a new study by Edward Chong and colleagues has shown that these sequences have been repurposed for controlling our immune system. So they affect when and where genes involved in immunity are activated. So it seems like we took these ancient viruses and we used them to rewire our immune systems to help us fight modern viruses.
Is this what part where they used to the stuff they used to call junk DNA, but now we know it really has a purpose, turning things on and off?
I mean, it's certainly part of that. It doesn't mean that all of what was called junk DNA is purposeful. It just means that some of it, bits of it seem to have found a use. Evolution has found ways of using this material to rewire the way our genes are activated.
Mm-hmm. Could it be possible that we are still collecting viral DNA?
Yeah, it's certainly possible. Modern viruses do insert their DNA, their genetic material, into our genomes. So this process could well still be ongoing. And we know that there are mobile elements, jumping genes, hopping around our genomes all the time.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting. Let's move on to an ecosystem is, of course, a delicate balance. And now we have a group of scientists who looked at how fear contributes to this balance?
So if you think about predators, people usually think about predators affecting the world around them through killing. But predators obviously cause fear as well. They terrify their prey. They cause animals to move away from some areas which are very risky and to congregate to safer areas. And this is this idea, this landscape of fear has been a long-standing one and a bit controversial because, for example, when wolves were reintroduced to Yellowstone National Park, some scientists suggested that they changed the ecosystem by causing fear. They frightened elk, which moved them away from certain trees, allowed trees to regrow, created material for beavers and songbirds. Whether that's true or not has been a subject of debate. This new study weighs in on that by looking at raccoons. So some raccoons on the Gulf Islands near Vancouver are notoriously bold. And by playing these animals the sounds of barking dogs on speakers, scientists showed that they did respond to the fear of the dogs and their response changed the world around them. So their prey in these islands grew in number. The prey of their prey shrunk away. So this entire web of life on the beach changed just because of fear of predators. Cool. And that, you know, that has implications for other parts of the world too.
Yeah, quite interesting. Finally, scientists are trying to figure out how to harvest water from air, and they look to beetles for inspiration and perspiration, perhaps?
Right, yeah. So there are beetles that live in the Namib Desert in southern Africa, one of the driest parts of the world. And they drink by moving into fog, raising their backs and allowing water to condense in their bodies and trickle into their mouths. And by mimicking some of the structures on these beetles, scientists have created this material that's excellent at harvesting water from fog. And not just the beetles, it takes inspiration from cactus spines mm-hmm. and from flesh-eating pitcher plants, which trap insects with super slippery leaves. And it uses those to create the material that collects water far more effectively than other state-of-the-art alternatives.
Yeah, wow. Quite interesting. Thank you, Ed.
Thanks, Art.
Ed Young is a science writer for The Atlantic. And now it's time to play Good Thing, Bad Thing. Because every story has a flip side. Time check. It's about 14 minutes past the hour, but which hour? Dealing with time zones can be a pain, so why not just get rid of them all? Well, two professors at Johns Hopkins, Richard Henry and Stephen Henke, have proposed doing away with all time zones and instead using one universal time clock everywhere. They also want to change the calendar so that the days of the month would always be the same. So if your birthday is on a Wednesday one year, it'll be on a Wednesday every year. Here to talk about whether it's time for a change is someone who's given a lot of thought about how our planets move around the sun. Dean Regas, outreach astronomer at the Cincinnati Observatory, co-host of the PBS program Stargazers. Welcome back, Dean.
Good afternoon. Thanks for having me.
All right, let's talk about the good news. What's the good thing about doing away with time zones?
We can go with the philosophy. It's right now everywhere. I mean, we can all agree with that. But it's really chaotic right now. That's the situation, is that every country has their own kind of political will to this. North Korea has their own time zone. Nepal has a time zone that's 45 minutes off kilter of anybody's. And China, for how big of a country, only has one time zone. So it's really, really complicated to keep up with all this. And one single unifying universal time zone could save a lot of hassles.
And so the bad thing?
When I first looked at this, I thought, okay, this is all bad. I mean, because first of all, if it's sunrise for everybody would be at a different time. So you could be, the sun would rise at midnight for you, according to this plan. And I was looking at this, who gets to decide who gets to be the zero point? Is it going to be Greenwich? Do they get to have sunrise at normal times and everybody else gets kind of the messed up? And I was looking at New York. This is great. If Greenwich was the zero point, like it is now for universal time, the sun would rise in New York at midnight on certain months and 1 a.m. at other times. So you could start your day at midnight. How does that sound?
Yeah. You know, I'm used to eating around noon, but I wouldn't be doing that, right?
No. And this is what it is, the bad part about this is humans and time. We have a thing about this. I mean, look at what we how we tell time. We have 60 minutes in an hour, 60 seconds in a minute. That goes back to the Babylonian days. Changing time, we are not good at changing things when it comes to time, that's for sure. If we're still following the Babylonians, this is going to be a hard sell, I think.
Yeah, well, you know, I think that you may be just a bit biased because I understand that a former director at the Cincinnati Observatory, helped establish time zones.
Ira, you found my bias, my time bias. Our second director, his name is Cleveland Abbey. He was one of the proponents, the early proponents of setting up time zones in the United States because railroads, you know, trains would be going from town to town and each town would have their own local time. So you could go from one town to the other and who knows what time.
Oh, well, seems like we lost Dean there a second. Well, time zones, are they a good idea? Or go to our website and leave your ideas about time zone. Good idea, bad idea? What do you think? Would you like to have one time zone? I said to somebody, let's talk at 3 o'clock. It would be 3 o'clock for everybody. I wouldn't have to say, gee, East Coast, West Coast. I talked to Dean over there in Cincinnati. Go to our website at sciencefriday.com and let us know what you think. Sorry, Dean. Dean Regas was outreach astronomer at Cincinnati University Observatory, and co-host of Stargazers. We're going to take a short break, and when we come back, we're going to talk about asteroid defense. Isn't it good, you know, to have people looking out? Maybe there is one coming to whiz by the Earth next Tuesday. What if it came too close? Would we, you know, how could we know that? Well, NASA's setting up a new coordinating planetary defense system. We'll talk about it after the break. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. A small asteroid is going to whiz by the Earth next week. We don't know exactly how close it's going to come. It could be as far away as 3 million miles from the planet. There's a slight chance it could come as close as 15,000 miles above the Earth's surface. But we do know that it's one of the thousands of asteroids and comets circling the sun in the same cosmic neighborhood of our planet. And in 1908, a small meteorite exploded over a remote area in Russia, knocking down 80 million trees, flattening 2,000 square kilometers of forest. It was Tunguska, remember that very, very, very famous event. And it was only due to luck, because it was so remote, that no one was hurt. Well, after many years of just talking about finding threatening space objects, NASA is helping to search for these asteroids and comets that might do real damage. Kelly Fast is the manager of NASA's Near Earth Object Observations Program, and Lindley Johnson is NASA's Planetary Defense Officer. They're both based out of NASA's headquarters. And we send a question out to you. What are your ideas about how we might defend ourselves against incoming asteroids? Our number 844-724-8255. You can also tweet us at SciFry, SCIFRI. Phone again, 844-724-8255. Welcome to the program.
Thank you, Ira. This is Lindley.
Thank you, Kelly.
Well, Lindley, let's first talk about the Planetary Defense Coordination. Sounds like a pretty big job. Tell us what are you coordinating?
Well, Ira, actually, NASA has been in this business for finding near-Earth objects, asteroids, and comets for a little over 15 years now. We started the program in 1998. This is just formalizing our capabilities, and the purpose of the Planetary Defense Coordination Office is oversight management of all NASA's projects to find and characterize asteroids, as well as figure out what we might do about one if it or a threat to impact. Plus, we work across the U.S. government agencies and with our international collaborators.
Is there a big plan internationally to coordinate looking for these asteroids?
Well, yes. We have been working within the form of the United Nations Committee on Peaceful Uses of Outer Space for several years. And with our other astronomers in space agencies in that committee. We've developed what is going to be a pattern for the international response to the asteroid hazard. We are working together in an international asteroid warning network, observatories around the world contributing observations to the Minor Planet Center. And then we also work with the space agencies in a forum called the Space Mission Planning Advisory Group, where we look at the technologies and techniques that could be implemented if we needed to divert an asteroid on impact trajectory.
We'll get up to that in a few minutes, but I want to talk about Congress, which put $50 million into the 2016 budget to set up this Planetary Defense Coordination Office, and that's more than double the budget for tracking asteroids in 2012. What happened? I mean, I was thinking, seen too many Bruce Willis movies, finally? Taking it for...
As we learn more and more about this hazard and get more and more folks up to speed on what the possibilities are that we could be impacted by something which could take us totally unaware unless we're looking out for it, there's been more interest and more support for the program at NASA. As I said, we've been doing this for some 15 years, and the budget has increased a little bit almost every year in the last 5 or 6 years.
Now, Kelly, you monitor near-Earth objects. What do we consider near?
Well, it would be asteroids or comets whose orbits bring them close to Earth's orbit. And so we might not be there at the same place at the same time, but we want to have an awareness of what is coming, perhaps too close for comfort. In order to track them, keep track of them, just so that there is something that is of concern, we can be aware of it. And just to be aware of the whole population that's out there, it even gives us a good science background for how things have evolved in the solar system. But it's also very practical for, one of our colleagues says, finding them before they find us.
Well, you did find one. I mean, there is news that a small object is supposed to come by next week sometime. And what I wonder about is every day I hear a different projection for this passing of a small asteroid. Some days it's on a Tuesday. Some days it's on a Wednesday. It's either 15,000 miles or it's 3 million miles. That's kind of scary that you don't know where it is.
Oh,
it's not quite that variable. But you're talking about 2013 TX68 is this designation. This was about a 30-meter asteroid that was found back in 2013. But we only got a couple of days of observations on it. And so the orbit that we can establish based on those few observations is somewhat uncertain. So that's why there's an uncertainty in the close approach distance to the Earth and exactly what day that close approach is. We know the orbit well enough that it's not an impact threat to the Earth, but it could come pretty close if it's out on the wings of that uncertainty curve.
But that object even isn't unusual. This sort of thing is actually happening all the time, coming perhaps different distances past the Earth. But there are close approaches made all the time by objects, but nothing that is of concern.
In fact, in the last couple of days, we've had objects of about that same size, 20 to 30 meters, that have come as close as the moon to the Earth.
But if you're coming as close as 15,000 miles, you're coming within the range of satellites that are up there, right? Couldn't it take a satellite out as it's coming through?
It's improbable that this object has come that close. Like I said, that's way out on the wings of the uncertainty curve. It's more likely that it is more than a million miles at closest approach. But we do. Find these objects that are coming in close to the Earth, 3 or 4 times a year. We have a small object of a few meters in size that will come within the geosynchronous belt of satellites. Mm-hmm. And we provide that information to to the space surveillance network that is run by the Air Force for the Department of Defense so that they can compare the trajectories of it to the satellite orbits to determine if there's any probability of impact. But the chances of that happening are, very, very slim.
All right. Let me give you for instance, let's say you do find something that is heading toward the Earth and might be a danger. We see in the movies that they're blowing these things up, but we know that's the worst thing that you can do because now we've got a million of that stuff heading in our way. Is it possible to actually practice a technique with a safe asteroid and see if that technique will work or not? Nudging it out of the way, so to speak.
Yeah. Well, as Kelly says, one of the objectives of our office is to find any object that might be a threat as early as we can so that we have many years to determine what is the best course of action to deflect it off its course. As I mentioned before, Space Mission Planning Advisory Group, what we call the Same Page, the forum for space agencies to talk about what we might do, are investigating technologies and techniques and working on mission concepts to demonstrate some of these techniques. For instance, one of the techniques is a kinetic impactor, and NASA is in parallel studies with the European Space Agency to launch a mission that would have a collaborative effort. The ESA would send out the observation spacecraft, and NASA would launch the kinetic impactor to demonstrate the kinetic impactor technique and deflect actually a moon of a small asteroid off its orbit in Glarge's orbit.
How exactly would the kinetic impactor work? I mean, to the layperson, it sounds like you're going to throw something at it.
well, so that's it.
Yeah, that's the basic concept. Is what you need to do to make what would be an impactor a mess is just change its velocity by a slight amount. And if you do that enough years in advance, you only have to change that velocity by a few millimeters per second. And so you just slam a kinetic impactor into it at the right velocity vector, and that will impart the energy to either speed it up or slow it down, depending which way you want to move it, enough so that a hit becomes a mess.
Mm-hmm. Kelly, how do you determine what asteroid is the most threatening to Earth? Is it based on an orbit or in composition or what?
Well, the Minor Planet Center collects observations from our asteroid survey assets, telescopes on the ground in space, and also and from elsewhere. And the JPL Center for Near Earth Object Studies works with that information and comes up with very precise orbit determinations with some uncertainties, as we saw with 2013 TX-68. That's why we need as many observations as possible so that they can really refine those orbits. And they keep track of all that, and they continue to update orbits as we can get more observations. And just by keeping that database and keeping track, they can model these objects in their orbits way out in the future to see if something might present a hazard. And so it's just a matter of collecting as many observations as possible, doing the orbit predictions with whatever uncertainties, whatever effects there might be that mm-hmm. could change things, such as other planets tweaking things or radiation from the sun, coming up with their best orbit determination. And then from that, assessing if something might present a hazard off in the future.
Of our current catalog of almost 14,000 near-Earth objects now, I think the highest probability of impact we have is for an object out in 2185, if I remember right, and it's like a 1 in 490 chance of impacting the Earth.
But there was a meteorite over Russia in 2013. Remember that one that a lot of people filmed?
Oh, yes.
You didn't see that one coming, did you?
No, we didn't see that one coming. Most of our survey telescopes are ground-based, and so therefore they can only observe at night. And this object came in the daytime out of the sun, But it was also a very small object, only a little less than 20 meters in size, and our systems really aren't capable of finding objects that small very far out in space. Mm. At best, we might see one coming inbound from the night side, maybe only a day or two before the impact.
Let's go to the phones. Let's go to Alan in Brooklyn, New York. Hi, Alan.
Thanks, Ira. I'm just wondering, unless I'm wrong, I haven't heard the same kind of opposition to investigating and spending money on this effort to stop asteroids as we've had in Congress to working against the threat of climate change. And if that's correct, do you think part of the reason has to do with the contractors who would benefit from the effort on asteroids who aren't equally benefited in the other way? And also, if we could ever get the kind of mobilization we need to fight asteroids, do you think that would change the perspective of people who've been opposing active work against climate change?
Let me just remind everybody that I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. Talking with Lindley Johnson and Kelly Fast of NASA, looking for objects in space that might hit us. Interesting question. Let me just reiterate, there's not been this opposition to this kind of work, and that NASA's given money over, Congress has given NASA money to this, as opposed to climate change research. Any
Well, Ira, I don't think anybody's getting rich off of off of this mission. Only $50 million a year of funding that NASA does on this. That's spread across a number of survey projects and grants. There isn't any major contractor involved in this at all. Most of our grants are to universities and space institutions.
And it's not just a NASA, just not just a NASA project, right? We were talking about the European Space Agency. You're coordinating
right.
a whole bunch of different things.
A whole bunch of different efforts. That's correct. And I think the other thing about this is something it's fairly simple to explain to folks that there are these objects out in space. We see them all the time. People see meteors all the time when they go out at night and look up at the sky. That's just the small end of what we're talking about. And there's in recent years, with all the video cameras that people have, people are taking lots of footage of these bolides. These are a little bit larger meteors that come into our atmosphere. So it's, I think, something that people can really relate to and see that there is a threat here. And having a couple of Hollywood movies that that entertain folks about it a little bit didn't hurt any well.
Kelly, are amateurs involved in this? You know, amateur
yes,
astronomers?
Actually. Yes, amateur astronomers also observe these objects. You know, they're with the smaller telescopes, they're limited in how faint they can go with looking at near-Earth asteroids and comets. But they are contributing, and they take observations and submit them to the Minor Planet Center. So, yes, they're involved also.
Mm-hmm. They also do what we call a light curve analysis mm-hmm. for us. They take over a course of a night take how bright the object is, and you see it differences in the brightness of the object, and that's an indication that it's rotating. And so from that, they can determine what the rotation of the object is. And in some cases, if it's done right, you can actually start to build up a shape model of the object.
Mm-hmm. And just in general, you do want to, in addition to finding them and tracking them, you do want to understand more about them, how they're shaped, what they're made of. Professional observatories do spectroscopy to characterize these objects, to figure out what they're made of. Are they more of rock? Are they metallic? Mm-hmm. And that's part of trying to get the big picture so that also feeds into if there is some sort of mitigation activity, you know what to do depending on what that object is made of and how large it is.
Thank you both. Kelly Fast, manager of NASA's Near-Earth Object Observation Program, and Lindley Johnson, NASA's Planetary Defense Officer, both based at NASA headquarters. We're going to take a break. When we come back, E.O. Wilson is going to join us to talk about setting aside half the Earth to Nature. We'll be right back after this break. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Last month, President Obama designated three new national monuments out in the California desert. You have the Mojave Trails, Sand to Snow, and Castle Mountains. All in all, they protect nearly 2 million acres of sand dunes, lava flows, snow-capped peaks, and Native American trading routes. But add it all up, and the tally of protected land in the U.S. is only about 14%. Worldwide, it's about the same. And that, according to my next guest, isn't nearly enough to stave off another mass extinction of the world's biodiversity. His prescription for the planet: to set aside half the Earth, half of it, including land and sea, for nature to do its things with no human intervention, sort of off limits to people. And he lays out his vision for how we'll get there in his new book, Half Earth, Our Planet's Fight for Life. Dr. E.O. Wilson is a professor emeritus at Harvard University and the author of Half Earth, and we have an excerpt of the book at sciencefriday.com/half-earth. And I have a question for all of our listeners while we're talking to Dr. Wilson. What areas of Earth that currently aren't protected, what areas not under protection, would you set aside for conservation? Our number, 844-724-8255, 844-724-8255, or tweet us at SciFry. Welcome back to Science Friday, Dr. Wilson.
Well, it's always a pleasure to be with you, Ara.
It's always a pleasure to have you. This half-Earth idea, it's not about taking a knife and splitting the Earth in half, is it?
No, not at all. It's a matter of putting together by in a Jerry Bell fashion, the remaining real wilderness areas, which are substantial, on the land, and the land that can be utilized in the category of a reserve around the world on down to relatively small plots. It also means it can be done easily in the sea, where we have 3% covered now, and we can take it up over 50% by simply setting aside the open seas and preventing fishing there. Now, before you respond by saying, oh, now that's impossible, it's not, because new studies have shown concerning the migration and the reproductive speed of open ocean going organisms, where a lot of the food supply comes from, that freeing it up and not fishing there anymore will actually supply the territorial maritime areas, the exclusive economic zones, in a way that increases substantially the total global marine production of fisheries and other marine life. That's just a peculiarity of the way the oceans work. And in the land, for the land, we go from 15% to 50. That's not as difficult either, as it might seem. Creating corridors, picking the largest areas that are available and designating them, and just moving it on up until we come to about half. And at one half, for reasons I can go into if we need to, at one half, we are now very roughly in a position of moving the extinction rate moving it down to 10 to 20% over what's going to happen over if we leave it alone.
So you're saying 80% of species would survive
That's the first crude estimate, but the relation between the size of a habitat and the number of species that can live in the habitat sustainably is pretty. It's pretty much of almost an ecological law, and an approximation of that is that the number of species that can be maintained in an area sustainably is roughly the same as the square root of the area. And so working off that and a lot of other information about sustaining a species, keeping them alive under different conditions, would allow us to piece together a worldwide reserve of, on the land, not just the sea, but the land, of half.
What's it going to take for you to convince the world's countries to do something like this? It's going to need a coordinated effort, right?
Yeah, well, yes, but we already have various devices within the United Nations and the help and support of a number of the developed nations to include the world's biodiversity, that is, the rest of life, and the habitats required to keep them in our foreign policy agenda.
According to the World Bank, countries like Germany and Slovenia have already protected about half their land, so it seems like at least in the right political climate, this sort of thing is possible.
There are a lot of countries that are in that position. The United States actually is one of them, Brazil, which has some of the one of the richest biological diversity in the world, along with Colombia and Ecuador, could manage that.
Mm-hmm. What about people who say, you know, a lot of these places might be where we grow our food? I mean, are we going to ask people to go without food?
Oh, yeah. Well, I've looked into this in some detail on food productivity and the present biological boundaries of the planet and so on. And it's not a bad picture if we have certain trends right now continue and the unintended consequences allowed to occur. That includes, according to United Nations projections, but I suspect others would come pretty close as well, we are going to peak at about a world population of about 10 to 11 billion. That's a 50% increase in population. And then start coming down. We have, in addition, an implosion into cities worldwide that's going on that's clearing land. As, for example, in Central America, there are areas that are regrowing in rainforests just from that alone. But then, in addition, we have high technology and some of the developments of high technology that are very promising for increasing productivity. As, for example, vertical gardens in warehouses with LED lighting can greatly boost a lot of the parts of agriculture, and on. The whole trend in the modern techno-scientific economy is toward more efficiency with less material and less energy. So what we should do is to encourage those, which we're getting better and better at anyway, and link it to setting aside reserves as fast as we can.
Mm-hmm. Or in case you're just joining us, talking with E.O. Wilson about his new book, Half Earth, mm-hmm. Our Planet's Fight for Life. A lot of folks want to get in on this. Let's go to Los Gatos, California, with Tom. Hi, Tom. Welcome to Science Friday.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call. You really have a fantastic show.
Thank you.
I'm happy to be part of. I'd like to start with the Pacific Ocean, which covers, you know, about a third of the Earth's surface, so they wouldn't have to relocate anyone. The people live on, like, Micronesian islands and so on, such a small population, even Australia, that they're really not making a big impact. It's the world demand, you know, for fish and other oceanic resources, oil and so on, that's the problem, and that should be restricted, year by year, maybe 10% a year for over 10 years until the ocean is pristine, all the plastic and everything in the Pacific gyre is cleaned up, and, the fisheries replaced by fish farming, even inland in the deserts, are they give the depleted fish stocks a chance to recover, including, the starfish, which has been decimated by some kind of a mysterious virus here on the Pacific, the west coast of the United States. It would be, we could even relocate people in big cities like in Japan who've had the Fukushima disaster and are in danger of other earthquakes, Nepal, and so on. to safe, stable land masses. And they're no, without respect of nationality, of course, race, gender, anything
right,
else.
Right, Tom, let me get a reaction.
I think there's a question in there somewhere. Yeah. And let me just see if I can fish
let's start with fishes. What? Start with fishing. I mean, most of the earth is covered in water, right? Is that a good place to begin?
Right. Well, that's right. And at the present time, we have driven the fisheries of the world down, according to one study involving about 170 populations, to between... only between 17 and 1% of their original quantity. And it's going on down with predictions of a lot of fisheries collapsing within 50 years. How do we get out of that? Well, one way we get out of it is, as I think I've just said, setting aside, that is making a reserve of the entire open ocean. And the result would be, it looks pretty firm to me, an increase in the worldwide production of the fisheries in the coastal waters.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to the phones. Let me go to the phones and move on because there's so many things and so little time. Let me go to Gainesville, Florida. Emilio, hi, welcome.
Hi, how are you? Thank you for taking my call, and I'm honored to speak to you, Professor Wilson. My question is as follows. I'm very sympathetic to the idea that we'll protect 50% of the world's ecosystems. I'm a tropical biologist myself, and I do a lot of my research in the Amazon, so I get to see firsthand what happens there. My question is, you know, we're going to put up walls around these areas and put them off, wall them off from humans, but humans have been living in them for millennia. They've shaped them ever since they've been there, and they're, in fact, living in them now. So what are we going to do with these communities of people who are who live there, who've always lived there, and who are central, I think, to both its conservation and its protection down the road?
Dr. Wilson, before you answer, let me just jump in here and remind everybody that I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. Okay.
Yep. Okay. Good question. Of course, it should be immediately on everyone's mind. And the answer is we're not going to move anybody. And we're not going to, this can be done without moving anybody, I should say, and it can be done without abrogating private property rights. The National Park System, unknown to most people, I guess, already has a series of methods by which this can be done to great efficiency, including the setting up of what is called the National Natural Landmarks. And that is to designate an area that's particularly rich and can be hopefully preserved. And then with that designation, allowing people who are there to continue being there and having their own property, there might be one person who owns all of it. But by persuasion, by pride, by agreement with many from the start on what the purposes of setting aside this particular valuable area may be, I think by persuasion alone, it'll be possible to do that. But there are a lot of others. One is to set up a park. This is the national, the fairly recent National Park Service policy, setting up a park and including with it what is known as, and in the same ecological domain, is called a preserve. And that is where hunting and fishing could be allowed. So the people who have been hunting and fishing in an area would be allowed and even encouraged to use the preserve. And there are other numerous methods mm-hmm. that can be used to build up land to a substantial amount without moving anybody or harming anyone's personal rights.
Aren't the most biologically rich places on the planet already protected in some way or another?
Oh, unfortunately not. Or if they are, you know, in on paper protected, that's being violated.
Such as?
The worst place, such as in magnitude, Indonesia, which has laws against the cutting of more rainforest in many very rich areas like Borneo, but the laws are just overlooked, and we're still getting massive cutting and burning throughout Indonesia to plant oil palm. Well, this comes down not to what government policy is, or is stated and voted upon, I guess, in their legislature or the equivalent. It comes on just public leaders, political leaders looking the other way. So if we can mount at the same time as realistic procedures to aim for that half Earth mark and the 80% or so species saved, then increasingly that can be a moral issue that might, I hope, eventually be universally accepted.
Well, good luck to you, Dr. Wilson, and it's a great book. It's called Half Earth. E.O. Wilson is a professor emeritus at Harvard University, and we have an excerpt of the book at sciencefriday.com/halfearth. Thanks for joining us today. One last thing. Last week on the show, Laurie Garrett made, as she calls it, an unpardonable blooper last week in referring with great excitement to a new study of HPV vaccines used in the U.S. She says, "I mistakenly blurted cancer reduction rather than HPV infection reduction in noting that within just 6 years of the introduction of the HPV vaccine, the rate of HPV in young women aged 20 to 24 has plummeted by a remarkable 64%. As one astute listener noted, it will be 20 or more years before a related drop in cervical carcinoma incidence will be seen. But in error, I blurted cancer rather than HPV in my hyper-enthusiastic comment." I want to thank Lori for that correction and for having such astute listeners. That's about it for this hour. Charles Berquist is our director. Our senior producer, Christopher Taliata. Alexa Lim is our associate producer. Our SciArts producer, Annie Minoff. Luke Raskin is our video producer. Rich Kim, our technical director. Sarah Fishman and Jack Horowitz, our engineers at the controls here at the studios of our production partners, the City University of New York. Please, you can go to our website at sciencefriday.com. You can also wait tweeting all week at SciFry. And if you like us, please go to Facebook and like us there, too. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.